This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a range of issues from my comic book collection, which I will select, sort of at random. Any books from my comic book collection are eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 139th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we're looking at Marvel Superheroes Magazine, number 4 from, of course, Marvel Comics, cover dated January 1995. This issue features full-length reprints of Daredevil 163, Fantastic Four 235, Incredible Hulk 317, and Iron Man 159. For coverage of issues 1, 2, and 3 of the magazine, which featured prior issues of all of those titles, I refer you to Quarter Bin episodes 109, 119, and 129. The reviews and discussions of each of these four full-length issues will, of course, be slightly shorter than the traditional full-length review and discussion that issues usually get on this show. The goal is for this not to be four times as long as the average episode. Now, based on the recording schedule for these episodes over my summer vacation, I don't have feedback yet for last episode because, as I record this, it still hasn't been released yet. But I did hear from DragonCon's Michael Bailey about my digression in episode 137 about language and the changing meaning of words. Professor Allen, I listened to the latest episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast while at work yesterday, so first, let me thank you for making building those chairs not something I normally have to do, but that's the way my day worked out, a little bit more bearable. Well, Mike, it is good to know that I'm not the only one who listens to podcasts at work. No, not while I'm actually lecturing, just to clarify. And I'm sure that Mr. Bailey has helped me pass the time during office hours and while grading the occasional assignment. He will get to a few comments on the issue itself, but he did want to address something else first. It was the commentary that didn't tie into the issue that got me thinking. The contextual nature of language is something we've been dealing with for decades. So what you talked about is by no means a new thing, but I think the last decade or so has made it a larger and louder conversation thanks to us being so connected with these fancy social medias and ways of expressing ourselves. I tend to go along with the flow up to a point. If a group wishes to be called something or seems to be offended by a certain term, I tend to avoid it in public. I put this on the same level as calling someone by the pronoun they wish to be called by. On the other hand, there is such a thing as taking it too far. The Holocaust was one of the worst things to happen in human history, especially in recent history. But that doesn't mean the word should only mean that. We could get into the weeds about how someone referring to an event as a Holocaust to drive home the point that it was terrible and whether that's offensive or not, or an overuse of the term, but I don't think that takes away from either the original meaning or how truly awful the Holocaust was. It's interesting that some would object to using the term in any other way than to describe the killing of millions of Jews, Roma, LGBTQ, and other groups, because I don't think referring to other things as a Holocaust takes away from that. My mind just doesn't go there in most cases. Now, things get dicier for me when you start talking about mascots for sports teams, but that's a deeper conversation for another time, and this email is already getting Bailey long. And I will say that is even with me cutting out a few bits. More than anything, I just wanted to express the thoughts I had based on your digression and how much I appreciated what you said, even if I didn't completely agree with it, because it got me thinking and firmed up some opinions in my own head. Glad to do that. Mike, whether it's my professional life or my podcasting hobby, provoking thought is one of the things I actually try to do. And this is a bold statement here in the late 2010s, but buddy, you don't have to agree with everything someone else believes to listen to them, and even kind of be friendly to them. To the specific issue that we talked about, Mike added, I enjoyed your thoughts on the various stories in Time Warp 1, which to me was always an amazing house ad. So it's nice to know that the stories inside mostly hold up. Oh, and I saw the ending to the story with the weatherman saving the world the moment you mentioned that the aliens received a broadcast from Earth. I didn't know it was weather-related, but I thought it would be a television show of some kind, so the idea was the same. Sounded like a fun story, though. Your friend, Mike. Thank you, DragonCon's Michael Bailey. Always appreciate your thoughtful insights and also your insightful thoughts. And we heard from a reigning listener of the year, Nathaniel Wayne of the Council of Geeks, in an email entitled, It's Just a Jump to the Left. Dear Alan, greetings
from space.
Nah, not really, but it fit the theme, and I really want to hear how much gusto you're prepared into reading that out loud. Well, I hope we pass the audition. I wasn't familiar with Time Warp, though the first thing that jumped out at me obviously was the title. As you may have guessed from my email subject, my first thought was the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I've spent a bit of time trying to figure out why that appeared to not factor into the thought process of the book's name, or at least not according to the creators. So I did some skimming. It's not the same as research. Shut up, Professor! And confirmed that Rocky Horror had been out sometime already. Now, of course, the film wasn't a hit right off the bat. But by 1977, the National Fan Club had been established, and the following only grew by 79 when this went to print. Only pass I can think to give it is that DC was based in California, and Rocky Horror was more prominently an East Coast phenomenon. I think I've mentioned previously that you and I come to compilation books with pretty much the opposite mentality. To be honest, Nathaniel, you and me come to a lot of things with pretty much the opposite mentality. Just saying. Being the skinflint that you are... Wait, what? You see them as a ton of stories for a quarter, whereas for me, as long as one of them is truly great, I'm happy to pay full price. The main one that I stuck with for a while was Heavy Metal, and I think even now it's still my favorite. At least, when I read it in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was much more open-ended in terms of genre and vibe than many other collections. Sci-fi usually was the most common, but it could be space opera, near future, cyberpunk, etc. And the book was also happy to drop in the occasional straight-up fantasy or horror story, though usually as one of the shorter offerings, to be fair. But even beyond that, the tone was all over the place, which I'm even more grateful for. Stories could be tense, they could be tragic, they could be adventurous, funny, romantic. I mean, how else will they justify these scantily clad women who adorn the covers otherwise? If you're wondering why I just went on a tangent about a completely different book than the one you were talking about, it crossed my mind, Nathaniel. It crossed my mind. It's to give context to my main takeaway. I probably wouldn't have much cared for Time Warp, because the tone seems pretty locked in. Bleak outcome for humanity, or at least the humans involved. Twist required, with only the fifth one diverging in tone, but the obligatory twist is still present. By the third story in that vein, I'd have gotten annoyed and possibly even bored. I tend to forget how reliant sci-fi stories, especially the shorter ones, used to be on twists, since the genre's gotten more open-ended as it's gone on. It's something I talked about on Ryan Daly's Midnight, the podcasting hour, in regards to horror. I like the trappings much more than the tropes, and often find the stories themselves formulaic. And I feel like this collection serves as a reminder to me that it wasn't a problem unique to horror. When twists are too endemic to a genre, you start expecting them, which robs them of some of the impact. The best twists happen in stories where you weren't even expecting there to be a twist at all. Now, a twist can still be clever, but when I'm watching for it, it has to be really good to to overcome my inherent jadedness at knowing it's coming. Lovely listening, as always. Geekily yours, Nathaniel Wayne, Council of Geeks. And shout-outs to both Godzilla's best friend in podcasting, Luke Giaconetti, and Dragon Con's Michael Bailey, who within about 8 hours of each other texted me pictures of the issues of Time Warp that they had just purchased earlier that day. Both gentlemen confessed to paying more than 25 cents, although not more than the dollar cover price. Good on you, boys. Good on you. And I wanted to give a shout out to Billy, the newly elevated co-host on Into the Weird with Herman. Billy also runs magazinesandmonsters.com, a very interesting blog. And Billy has just recently discovered us here at Relatively Geeky in general, and the Quarter Bin in particular. A very interesting blog. But now it's time for the main event. So let's turn here to our discussion of our comic for this episode. Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 4 had an original cover price of $2.95. Meaning I got an excellent 91.5% discount on this book. I nabbed issues 1 for 5 of this title a few years back from my LCS World's Greatest Comics, and I'm going to cover those on every number 9 episode. We started on 109, then 119, third issue on 129, here on 139, and we'll wrap it up on 149. Now, I can't remember who it was, but some listener said I ought to calculate that discount off the original cover price of the original issues, which is interesting because this reprint title was actually sold at a premium, as those original cover prices only added to $2, meaning the quarter that I paid was an 87.5% discount off the combined original single issue prices for these stories. And thinking about all of that brings up a question. As I said, I was only able to nab issues 1 through 5 of the series, not picking up the last one. And it's very unlikely that I'll find number 6 in a quarter bin. And I say that for two reasons. One, when I nabbed these in the quarter bins at World's Greatest, Keith said very specifically that he only had the first 5. And two, I've never seen any of them ever in any other quarter bin. But here's my thinking. If I find issue number 6 for any price up to a dollar, stop, calm down, hear me out first. If I find it for any price up to a dollar, it does have 4 complete reprinted issues in it. Doesn't that mean that each story, although not the whole mag, but each story would qualify under my strictly enforced rules of the Quarter Bin podcast? I'm gonna need to ponder that one for a while. Yeah, I'm gonna need to ponder that while I play this promo.
Grom, I have never prayed to you before. I have no tongue for it. No one, not even you, will remember if we were good men or bad. Why we bought, why we sold on eBay. All that matters is that 50 cent Captain Kirk Mego action figure. That's what's important. Cheapness pleases you, Grom. So grab me one request. Grab me the fruit of Suburbia's garage sales. Let me drive those dealers away from that box of records and hear the lamentations of the children as I buy their Star Wars toys for a quarter. And if you do not listen, then to hell with you!
Hello, I'm Chris Honeywell, and I make my living going to garage sales and then selling the junk I find on eBay. That's right, just like those a**s on TV. You can hear a podcast all about it where I tell you about all the good junk I got, how I sold it, give you tips, gripe, bitch, and moan, and even have friends come along with me. So check it out. It's called Garage Sale Gloat, and it can only be found at twotruefreaks.com. which is, of course, the home of the Two True Freaks Network. Duh.
The cover to Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 4 is by Lee Weeks. On it, a very large and very green Hulk is looming over Daredevil, and in three small circles at the bottom of the page, we see The Thing, Sue Storm, and Iron Man. Now, this is a great cover for a few reasons. First, the Hulk and Daredevil forms look pretty great. And second, most important, I probably should have listed this first, but with a book that covers Daredevil, the Hulk, Iron Man, and the Fantastic Four, any artist who chooses to not depict Mr. So-called Fantastic on the cover, someone like Lee Weeks, who recognizes, who is willing to admit that stretchy McButtface does not sell comics, nor does he add to the general artistic quality of a piece. If you can't put Dr. Doom on your cover, which is obviously every artist's preferred path, their first choice, the second best thing a cover artist can do is not put Mr. What's-His-Name on the cover. Good job, Mr. Lee Weeks. We, the proud members of Food, Friends of Old Doom, we salute you. Now, back in episode 109, I agonized a bit about the format for these number 9 episodes and settled on the idea of selecting one story in the issue as the lead story, which will get a little bit fuller examination, a little closer to the regular quarter bin treatment, with the other three being treated as the backup stories for the episode, not getting quite as much podcast time, perhaps, as the main story. So first time around, it was the Iron Man story that was chosen, Iron Man 115, as it was my favorite of the four. And I wanted to do a different lead story each time for these episodes, so for number 2, that was the Hulk, and number 3 was Daredevil, which leaves us with the Fantastic Four for this one. Again, let me emphasize this. So this statement is not taken out of context. It's not that the Fantastic Four was my favorite anything. Ever, not for any reason, any time, any place. We are simply giving that story fuller treatment in this issue because it was the last one to be picked. Think of the FF for this issue as the crumbs from the leftovers of Thanksgiving dinner, because that's how I think of them. And looking at the story that first appeared in Fantastic Four 235, originally cover dated October 1981, Four Against Ego was written and drawn by John Byrne, or as they put it in the issue, Words and Pictures by John Byrne. For this story, and for all the stories in the episode, both the Marvel Wikia and Comic Book DB were used as jumping-off points for crafting these story synopses. For this one, we start with the Thing, a large device strapped to his back, and the big orange rock monster is traveling deeper and deeper into the organic tunnels that run inside the form of Ego, the living planet. The heat and internal pressure is so intense, it threatens to sap Ben of his strength and endurance. Pausing for a moment to rest and collect himself, he thinks back to the moments that led to this point. And then we get a recap of last issue, how New York City was rocked by a devastating earthquake. Rushing back to the Baxter Building, Ben learned that the source of the quake originated in outer space. To fight this potential threat to the Earth, Reed prepared a ship, and the FF traveled out into space to intercept the approaching menace. And as soon as they reached their destination, they were shocked to discover the attacker. I am the living planet. I am Ego. And I am death. Then, back to new material, Ego unleashes a force blast on the FF spaceship, and they end up crash landing on the surface. The FF survive, thanks to Johnny getting out and using his flame powers to burn clear a path so they can land safely. Incredible. We're looking at the skin of a living being the size of a planet. But the stench, Sue points out. It's horrible. So they set about the task of exploring the strange world of Ego, and Reed quickly spots a massive propulsion unit stuck on the planet's surface. This is how Ego is traveling through space to get to Earth. I learned to control the engine. I made it serve my will. It is now mine. Now Reed and his team of blue-clad troublemakers fire up the sky cycles to investigate that massive engine. Detecting what the heroes are up to, Ego's face appears on the side of a mountain and blows them off their jet cycles. The quartet lands safely on the ground, but they are attacked by an army of Ego's antibodies. The four manage to fight past them and reach the propulsion unit where Johnny erects a flame barrier to keep the antibodies at bay. He is horrified when the seemingly endless armies of these antibodies begin throwing themselves into the flames, appearing to commit suicide to stop them. But Reed allays his concerns about that. They have no life of their own. They are just cells of Ego's body. Johnny, you destroy more living things each time you get a haircut. Now, meanwhile, back on Earth, Johnny's girlfriend, Frankie Ray, has just finished taking a shower. When she realizes that there are no towels in the bathroom, she is forced to go out into her apartment unclad, and she just hates running around Starkers. She worries that her roommate will come home and catch her bare naked, and then Frankie catches a glimpse of herself in the mirror. And like many of us comic book fans and podcasters, she is horrified by what she sees there. Now back on Ego's planet, Ben is still filling us in on what happened since the end of last issue. Reed has instructed Ben on how to remove one of the mini-packs that powers one of the jets of the propulsion unit. Reed tells the rest of his team how he intends to use it to destroy Ego's brain, which would hopefully render him harmless, but seeing as it's Reed, he may not know a bit about what he's talking about. Suddenly, Ego forms a new massive body that just towers over them, and the living planet begins an all-out attack. The four manage to flee their attacker through one of the pores on Ego's surface, and they follow the complex tunnels until they come across what they think is Ego's brain. However, after close examination, Reed concludes that it is a fake constructed by Ego to trick them, and he orders Johnny to destroy it with a flame. Ego protests, but the FF continue on their path to the real brain of Ego. But the deeper they go into the living planet, the hotter it is, and the more the pressure intensifies. Reed is the first one to give in to the environment, forcing him to stay behind just because, you know, general weakness and sort of being a total poopy head. Soon afterwards, Sue, and later Johnny, are also unable to go any further because of their status as losers. And this leaves Ben to continue on the trek alone. And here is finally where we get caught up with the scene from the first page, with Ben and the big device striped to his back. Pressing on, he finally reaches the true, honest-to-gosh, no fooling this time, brain of Ego. Holy cow, that thing must be as big as a moon! Suddenly, his orange rocky mind is flooded with images being pushed into his brain by Ego. He witnesses the birth of Ego during the Big Bang that created the universe. Sees his conflicts with Galactus, and how he once allowed Thor to have Wanderers settle on his surface, only to consume them after the Thunder God departed. Lastly, Ego shows the Thing how his last encounter with Thor and Galactus ended with the propulsion unit being attached to his planetary mass and sent hurtling into space. Realizing that Ego was coming to Earth because it was the last place Galactus had been, the Thing then tosses the mini-pack at Ego's brain, but misses. Despite this gross incompetence, Ego angrily reacts, trying to activate the propulsion unit to send him on a collision course with the planet Earth. However, because only one of the engines on the propulsion unit is active at that moment, Ego instead veers directly into the sun. The resulting heat and gravitational pull of the sun tear Ego apart, sending Ben hurtling into space. However, the Thing is rescued from the vacuum of space by his teammates, who arrive on their ship and pull him to safety. With Ego seemingly destroyed, seemingly might be the key word here, and his threat to Earth now gone, the FF can begin their journey home. The end. Well, considering the troubling content of Mr. Look Who Thinks He's Fantastic being a major part of this, this is actually not a bad comic story. If I didn't explain this well enough during the synopsis, Byrne does a really nice job here with the narrative structure, with the chronology of the story. We start in medias res, much time and action having obviously passed since the end of last issue, with Ben heading deep into the caves of Ego. So as a reader, we have to slow down a bit, because this is not what we're expecting. We're not picking up exactly at the end of last issue. We're picking up after some time has passed, some events have occurred. So we're expecting more of Ego, but that's not what we get. We get the big orange rock monster as our first scene. Then, through the technique of Ben's recollections, we recap the prior issue, which ended with that dramatic appearance of Ego. Now, I'm of two minds of doing the recaps in this manner, of integrating them into the body of the story, as opposed to the more recent Marvel practice of the one-page written recap. Both have advantages and disadvantages. Now, this version enables the artist to retell those prior pages and panels with different angles and layouts, and that can be intriguing. But not every artist does that, and not every writer is as good as integrating those recaps in an interesting way. So sometimes those can read a bit slow, a bit boring. But not this one, mind you. That is not what I'm saying. But not every comics creator is John Byrne near the top of his game. And so I can see how the one-page recap is a safer way to go. But anyway, here we get the recap, and then we get more than 10 pages that fill in the blanks between the recap and the scene from the first page. And when we do get caught up to Ben running deep inside Ego looking for the brain, the issue is over like 5 or 6 pages later. And that is really interesting pacing. I think it's really strong pacing. You're not jumping around in time or jumping around from storyline to storyline, except for that one page with Frankie Ray. The rest of the story, the A story, is told actually in order, but by using a few simple writing tricks, Byrne cranks up the pacing and cranks up the tension. Now, I say the word trick as in writing trick, but I don't mean it in a negative way, because the story itself is very strong. Sometimes you get the feeling that a writer uses tricks, like non-chronological storytelling, or jumping from timeline to timeline, or character to character, or time jumps, or just general plot confusion to paper over a story that otherwise has problems, but that's not what John Byrne is doing here. The story is strong, and his writing style just makes it even better. Another strength in this story is the way that the action between the team is balanced. Ben gets most of the action scenes, and we are in his recollections for the first half or two-thirds of the story, but even then, we are seeing recollections of the other three teammates. And when they're all fighting Ego, all four get their moments to shine, and each uses their powers in specific, distinct, individual ways. And they team up at points, combining their powers. And of course, the family banter is strong as well. And we've all read team books, or even team-up books, where it seems that the writer has a firm control on maybe one of the characters, that they treat that as the lead and everyone else as a backup. But John Byrne here seems to have an affection and an interest in everyone, even that dreadful Reed person. And he has a handle on their powers and on their relationships, and that really shows. Now, anytime you send the FF to outer space, you're going to be compared to Jack Kirby, who used the FF in outer space to push forward the art of the comics medium, talking about the photo collages and all of that. Now, Byrne is smart enough to not try to replicate or imitate that, but I think he does a really good job with the space stuff. It's appropriately dark in space, until they get near the sun at least. And inside of Ego, that is where Byrne's attention to detail and artistic imaginations get a really chance to run wild. Very well done. Both the story and the art, this really is top-notch work. And it's hard to read a story about Ego and not think of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Now, they changed Ego, I think, pretty substantially to make him part of that movie series. And in that context, I think it worked. But in terms of the character himself or itself, I actually like this version of Ego. Of course, Thinking back to the movie, it's hard to beat the casting of Kurt Russell, especially for how dark that storyline turned out. He was the perfect choice. But in terms of the character itself, I like, again, the comic book version of Ego. And there is a nice subtlety at the end, where after Ego is deposited into the gravitational pull of the sun, the team finds themselves in that part of the solar system, in Mercury's neighborhood. And while they're jawing among themselves about the battle, Sue points out that they have time to work it all out, as it will take them days to get back to Earth. Now, in real life, I imagine it would take weeks and weeks, months and months to get back to Earth from where they are, but even the fact that Byrne is saying it's going to take days to do so, he is recognizing that space is really, really big. Even space just within our solar system. And that's a nice little button on the story, both in terms of that nod to science and speeds and distances, and also because of the nature of the book. Because what's going to happen next, we're not going to see it, but we're going to have an off-screen family road trip. Talk about ending a serious story on kind of a light family note. Very well done. Well, there are three more stories in this jam-packed, overstuffed magazine of an issue, and we do have to get to those. So after this promo for another podcast, which co-stars Derek William Crabb, a new member of the hashtag comic book circle of life, we'll be back to look at stories featuring Daredevil, Iron Man, and Hulk.
This be some spread. Gambit not gonna be playing solitaire tonight.
Gambit, what are you doing over here? Talking to yourself in the third person. And what's all this food?
Oh, Professor, Gambit have plans tonight. Once Cher shows up, Gambit gonna wine and dine her. Then we gonna listen to Fan Holes, the pop culture podcast made for the fans by the fans.
Fan Holes? I'll not have my school turned into a den of debauchery and science fiction trivia. No, Gambit. You'll just have to perform your obscene mating rituals elsewhere.
Uh-oh. Sound like the professor getting a little cranky. Gambit think it time for you to go to bed.
What? What are you... Ow! Unhand me at once! Unhand me, you swamp-fed ignoramus!
Relax, mon ami. Gambit just gonna tuck you in real nice.
X-Men, emergency, help! Curse you, fan holes!
Hey, don't mess with the fan holes!
Weekly content on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and fanholespodcast.blogspot.com.
I can pay you to kiss from love.
That damn song is stuck in my head now. Thanks a lot, Pete Holmes. My mind!
And we're back with the other three stories in this issue. And we'll cover them in the order in which they appear in Marvel Magazine number 4, which brings us to Daredevil, 163 originally, cover dated March 1980, making this the oldest or earliest reprint in the issue. The story, Blind Alley, was written by Roger McKenzie with art by Frank Miller, Klaus Janson, and Joe Rubinstein. Yes. The magazine did skip issue 162, which was a fill-in by Michael Fleischer and Steve Ditko. We start. At a political fundraiser, a $100 a plate dinner that has attracted J. Jonah Jameson, Foggy Nelson, Tony Stark, Matt Murdock, Heather Glenn, and her new boyfriend, Rico, who she met at the disco. Because 1980. At the soiree, Daredevil detects that the Hulk is loose in New York City, still in his civilian attire, Matt throws himself off the roof of the building and lands right in front of the Hulk. Matt coaxes the Hulk into turning into his human alter ego Bruce Banner to avoid the others who are coming with tanks and guns to kill him. Violence is not the answer. I can help you find him, Hulk. Do you understand? I can help you, but you have to trust me. Matt takes Bruce into his home and lets him rest until he awakens from the same nightmare he's had over and over again. After Murdoch tells him what's been going on, fills him in, Banner goes on his way to leave the city, thanking Murdoch for his help. Hulk again comes out, and Daredevil confronts him again and is whipped up upon. Hulk considers killing Daredevil, which he could easily do. But rather than that, he leaves the hero motionless on the streets of NYC while a confused Hulk leaps out of the city. And in an epilogue, because things need to get just a little worse for Daredevil, Ben Urich proofreads his article, revealing Daredevil's identity as Matt Murdock. The end. Now, I just made a joke about it, but there is some truth to it. Just because Daredevil's life is going badly, like getting pulverized repeatedly by the Hulk, it doesn't mean that his life can't get worse, because it seems like next issue, it's about to get worse. I'm not sure if this is the point in Daredevil's storyline where Frank Miller starts flexing his muscles, starting to captain the ship a bit, because that was certainly his move, making Matt's life worse and worse and worse. And that, again, seems to be what's happening here. And I do like the turning on the head of the typical Marvel team-up formula of heroes meet, heroes fight, and then heroes get along. Because in this issue, they meet, they get along, and then they fight. And the fight is incredibly one-sided. I think I probably blew by that pretty quickly in the synopsis, but DD has no chance. And Miller shows no mercy in showing him having no chance. His nose is bloodied. He's struggling to stand. It is, in fact, quite reminiscent of some of the fight scenes in the Daredevil Netflix series. There's a great scene of Hulk crashing through the street from below as he jumps out of the subway car. It's a really nice piece of work. You see Hulk's energy just all coiled up. He's just flying out of the street below and into the air. I like that opening scene at the fundraiser with all the Marvel characters there, JJJ and Tony Stark, get into a bit of an argument about how the newspaper man has been treating Spider-Man. And in the background, you do hear and see people talking about the Hulk. He's on the front page of the Bugle, having been spotted in that general area, that part of the city. So that's a cool scene in that it shows us some of Daredevil's extended cast, but also shows us characters from around the larger Marvel Universe. And a big event like this is a reasonable reason to bring a few of them together. And the Hulk is there as a topic of conversation. So that scene is not just a glimpse of the greater world of Marvel Comics, which is nice in and of itself, but it does set the scene for the Hulk's arrival in the issue. It's a very well thought out and well plotted issue. There is a scene early on that I think I skipped over in that synopsis of Banner on the New York subway, and between the guy coughing and the pushing and the shoving and the guy with the boombox, he just hulks out. And that is the scene I mentioned before of him leaping out of the ground. And now, I've never been to New York City, but I can see it being a really stressful place, especially the crowded nature of the subway. And if I were afflicted in the way that Banner is afflicted, I'd probably be forced to hulk out as well. And that brings us to The Invincible Iron Man 159, a book originally cover dated June 1982. The story, When Diablo Strikes, was written again by Roger McKenzie, with pencils by Paul Smith and inks by many hands. And yes, that is 42 issues later than the issue in the last Magazine 117. No, I don't know why they jump that far in the Iron Man history, although we will address that in a few minutes. I have a hypothesis, I guess. But the story starts with thunder rumbling ominously, drowning the muffled roar of Iron Man's suit as he streaks about Manhattan. If the news report I heard is true, I don't have a moment to lose. He makes it to the Roosevelt Island tramway in time to save some commuters from a snapped cable. He lets the repair worker know that Stark International can supply whatever they need for repairs by the end of the day. Because sure, a big government like New York City does not have a procurement policy that takes months and months to navigate. Returning to Stark International, Tony is informed by his security chief, Vic Martinelli, that a new janitor with no employment history named Al Bito has somehow started working for the company. Stark finds the newly hired man helping solve some chemistry problems in that department with a difficult equation, and he does it with ease. But he's not sure how he accomplished that. Somehow, I just know. Stark drops Bito off at the staff psychologist, who brings his memory back through hypnosis. Which would be cool, except that Bito is in fact, well, since it was in the title of the story, and I already read that, that does diminish the dramatic reveal that Bito is in fact Diablo, Master Alchemist. Diablo, by the way, is an anagram for Al Bito. Whoever came up with this whole secret identity, I'm just saying, maybe not the brightest bulb in the Marvel Universe. Now, Bito, Diablo, ended up here as a janitor as a result of the FF and that meddling fool of a sorcerer, Doctor Strange. Well, now that explains it perfectly. That was probably Reed's idea of a super secret name. Now, Diablo quickly renders his psychologist, Dr. Huff, unconscious, and then disguised as Stark, takes over the chemistry lab. The security chief lets Tony know that something weird is going on, and the fact that the building is glowing is also another clue. Iron Man investigates the glowing building, only to be attacked by a green two-headed dragon, but a few repulsor blasts take care of that. Diablo whirlwinds Tony out of the building, and then he creates a concrete giant out of the sidewalk to attack him. While Tony defeats the stone golem, Diablo stumbles onto Tony's old workshop, which contains many of his old armors, which he animates. Finding himself surrounded by earlier versions of himself, Iron Man fights. He manages to scrack and slam and even shunk his way through the battle and turns to the mastermind. Diablo, I hope your insurance is paid up. And then Iron Man really goes to town on Diablo. And in the epilogue, the Fantastic Four retrieve the villain, promising to keep a better eye on him this time, and maybe come up with a better code name. But Tony knows, given the FF's general level of competence, skill, intelligence, we all know that Diablo will be out soon, wreaking havoc on the world. The end. You know, given how much the Marvel movies have influenced my view of these characters, it was really weird to have a scene of Tony putting on his armor, like physically putting it on his body. They make a deal about how quickly he can make the change and the technology, like the magnets that lock it into place. But the movies have totally spoiled me for scenes like this. I mentioned the time jump or the issue jump here in the reprint. I wondered why we moved 3.5 years ahead in terms of issues. But having read it, maybe it was the thematic aspect of having team-ups in these stories, of having stories with other members of the Marvel Universe, and specifically with other characters who are also appearing in this magazine. So we just read a Daredevil story that featured the Hulk. And here we have an Iron Man story that includes the FF. So maybe the idea was to make the book seem more cohesive, And also, spoilers, Magazine 5 has a bit of a format change. So maybe they were also looking for a one-off story, a story that didn't continue into the next issue, to transition into what's going to be the next issue of the magazine. And if the goal was either of those, much less both of them, I think they managed to accomplish it. It was an interesting choice of a story. And of course, as a fan of the controversial DC story Identity Crisis, I do have to point out that the FF's plan for dealing with Diablo at the end of their last confrontation, and this was certainly Reed's idea, you have to believe, with his dark and evil impulses, his plan was to call in Doctor Strange to perform a little mind wipe on the villain. Huh. Interesting choice there, Reed. Now, in case I didn't make myself clear, this is a really good story. Sure, there's Diablo and Tony's old armors and a stone giant, but this story makes two important points about the Richards family of blue-clad troublemakers. One, they are a bunch of evil, mind-wiping villains, and two, they aren't very competent at it. This is the kind of story that hashtag Big Comic would never let be published today, so let's just revel in what we have here. Brilliant. Genius. There's only one other thing we can say about this one.
Hail Doom!
And rounding out our episode, rounding out this issue of the magazine, is Incredible Hulk 317, an issue originally cover dated March 1986. Making this the most recent or newest story in the collection. The story, you're probably wondering why I called you here today, was scripted, penciled, and inked by John Byrne with additional inks from Keith Williams. To refresh your memory, at the end of the last issue of Hulk, She-Hulk and Betty agree to let Dr. Fisher inject his psychoactive drugs into Bruce, and he suddenly wakes up, struggling, as his system begins to normalize. Awake for the first time after his separation from the Hulk, the first person that Banner sees is his beloved Betty Ross. This one starts with Banner in a Charles Xavier-style high-tech wheelchair. Since the end of last issue, he's been released from hospital, and now he has set up operations in a new Hulkbusters base, and is in the process of forming his own team of Hulkbusters, made up of a demo expert, an aquatic researcher, a hostile terrain expert, a xenobiologist, and a geophysicist. And then they all walk into a bar. No, I'm just kidding about that. Banner tells his team that he has gathered them together to destroy the Hulk once and for all. At first, these gathered professionals refuse to sign on, but when Banner points out that they've all been blacklisted from their chosen professions for one reason or another, they have little else to do. And now, if you look for them in the Los Angeles underground, maybe you can hire the Hulkbusters. Now, meanwhile, the green-haired Professor Doc Samson continues to hunt the Hulk across the New Mexico desert. His search is interrupted by reporter Diane Bellamy, who tries to convince him to allow her to join him. She shows him a two-person helicopter that she got on loan from her TV station to help them in their search. As Samson explains how dangerous it is, the Hulk suddenly emerges from the ground, having been hiding in the area the whole time. Pushing the reporter lady aside, Samson and Hulk go at it mano a mano. Back at Hulkbuster base, the team meets and decides to take up Banner's offer and become Hulkbusters. Banner begins to record his thoughts in a journal as this new chapter in his life begins. The man knows that he needs to gather the strength to do what needs doing. Back in the desert, Diane continues to record the Hulk, Doc Samson fight, which turns deadly when the Hulk causes a landslide. With the Hulk leaping away, Samson is forced to prevent Diane from being smothered alive, allowing the Hulk to escape. When she insists that she tag along with him, Samson knocks her out and takes her helicopter. But being a gentleman, he radios her TV station to tell them where to find Diane, so it's not that bad. You know, where they can find the knocked out, unconscious Diane. Back at Hulkbuster Base, Bruce finds Betty and tells her how devastated he'd be if she were ever hurt. She jumps to a conclusion and pleads with Bruce, "Please don't ask me to leave." But Bruce clarifies, "No, Betty, no. I'm not asking you to leave. Not ever. I'm asking you to marry me." The end. First, we have to talk about Samson and his treatment of the lady reporter. And this is because I've raved about how much I like Samson. And of course, having a superhero who moonlights as a college professor, or maybe it's vice versa, that's just pretty cool for me to see for someone in my line of work. But we do need to talk about a couple of scenes. First, as Hulk reveals himself from his hiding place, Doc pushes her down and tells her to get to her copter. But she doesn't, and so later, when he needs to steal her helicopter, he, with a quiet tock, punches her chin, rendering her unconscious. There are so many things he could have done here, including just pushing her away again and just stealing the copter. There's no reason for him to strike her, but there it is. And his excuse? "Sorry, Diane. It's going to be hard enough to stop the Hulk as it is. I won't have time to keep you out of trouble, too." So yeah, there are positive things to say about this character, like she is a courageous, highly skilled professional. And maybe if she'd been male, he would have also wanted to be left alone and not have to care for a reporter. Jimmy Olsen may also have deserved this treatment, I suppose, in terms of Samson's approach. But it's not a Jimmy, it's a Diane. And still, that difference in gender makes for, I think, a difference in what are acceptable behaviors towards a troublesome reporter, I think. But of course, the end of the issue is the key, the proposal. I like that. Bruce is free of the Hulk, free of the reason why he and Betty couldn't be together. And so it makes sense that one of the things that would be high on his list of "now that I'm not the Hulk anymore" would be propose to Betty. And the scene itself is cute. There's a misunderstanding. He's clearly nervous. That scene really worked. And lastly, I have to talk about the layout of the story within this reprinted issue because it's really weird. The Iron Man story ends on a left page in the reprint, and the right page opposite is the opening splash of Bruce from this story. No background, and his dialogue is the title of the story. You're probably wondering why I called you here today. And it is a cool-looking page, an attention-getting page. And then you flip it, and you get 2 pages of Marvel house ads. And then you get 9 consecutive story pages before the next house ad. The majority of the interior ads, by the way, are house ads, but that's not the point. The point is, why the heck do you put those ads right there? Why not between the stories? Or why not after 5 or 6 pages of the story? Any place other than after just 1 page. I don't think I've ever seen that, certainly in an original story. The ads don't start on page 2. And even in a reprint, I don't think I've ever seen such a bizarre layout choice like that. And it's a good thing I'm not easily swayed by design issues such as that. Otherwise, that could really affect my verdict. The verdict. On Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 4, 96 pages of solid Marvel Comics, John Byrne, Miller and Jansen, more John Byrne. Did I mention it was 96 pages? These are top quality reprints at a bargain price. This is a total quarter bin steal. I have not read any of these individual runs before, but have really enjoyed reading these magazines, and I expect I'll really enjoy the next magazine as well, although, like I said earlier, it is laid out a little bit differently from the first 4. Spoilers for 10 episodes from now. Now that wraps up my coverage of Marvel Superheroes Magazine number 4, bringing episode 139 of the Quarterbin Podcast to a close. Now here's the thing. Between issues 137, 138, and 139, in other words, Time Warp, Mos Eisley, and this magazine, 3 episodes, 3 comics, but 15 separate stories. And that's a lot. So what I'm hoping to do over the next handful of episodes, the next handful of issues that I pick, I intend them to have just one story each. That doesn't necessarily mean shorter episodes, although the last couple have pushed the hour mark, so it might lead to that. I would just like to prep for just one story per episode for a little while. So, for next time, for episode 140, I took the chance of trusting my listeners, or at least Twitter followers, by running a poll to help me decide what to cover. A selection of issues that had one story each. And that vote led me to Booster Gold, number 6 from DC Comics, cover dated July 1986. If you have any questions or comments about these issues, the episode, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next time, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the Quarterbin. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family of podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Sir!